This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
Meanwhile, we say, there's nothing in particular that we have to remember. Including that there's nothing in particular that we have to remember. And while that's true, sometimes people don't find that very encouraging. So over the years, a great deal of more explicit teaching has been produced. So that people can find, or anyway, have some feeling that they can locate themselves someplace in the universe of practice. Because if they don't, then, well, again, they may get discouraged and just kind of feel lost, and that will perhaps prove too severe a test for their faith. People's faith is too severely tested, sometimes the result is despair, and then things go from bad to worse. So we definitely don't want that to happen. So one of the things we say people can remember if they want to, even though there isn't anything in particular to remember, we could say people can remember that this person is, in spite of appearances, is an open system. The effect of the functioning of the skandhas, the aggregates, is usually just the opposite. Namely, they behave as though they were a closed system. with the result that sentient beings tend to feel like they are more or less each kind of like a goldfish in a bowl swimming around. And sometimes they may think they can dimly see something through the glass of the bowl, but they can't really make out much. And generally their sense of the bowl in which they swim is one of confinement and is rather unsatisfactory. However, this is an illusion, as Buddha taught. And the effective practice is to reveal that illusion, and to reveal that the sense organs and their objects and the associated consciousnesses that Buddha taught about is actually an open system. Meaning that it does not enclose a person. So, in Vajrayana practice, you know, there's this concept of the so-called rainbow body. And the adept can generate a so-called rainbow body. But in Zen, we could say that we contemplate actually this body as a rainbow body, which is to say, this actual body, which we feel to be so painfully real, is like the rainbow cast by light passing through a prism. And the prism is kind of like, among other things, a karma. But the way it functions is very similar. And the illusion is thorough enough that it permits sentient beings to believe that they are unique and permanently individual. And that, of course, is the basic delusion. And, as Buddha said, the root of all suffering. So if we want to remember something, we might remember that as we pass through our life with this sense that we are surely a closed, coherent system, that just might be an illusion. And that body, mind, and person is in fact a system that is completely open to the universe. And in fact, if we practice according to the ways we've been taught, that truth, if you like, will start to become self-evident. And will start to supplant the bad habit of thinking that this person is a closed system. Our stories are full of hints about this, our Zen stories. You can find explicit teachings about this if you want. But as you may have noticed in Chan and Zen, generally there's some explicit teachings about it, but usually the teachings tend to be a little indirect in order to thwart the tendency of the thinking mind to grab on to those teachings and kind of work them to death. A Chan would prefer to present Dharma from a kind of unusual angle. Hence, when we encounter our Zen stories, they strike us often as kind of peculiar, because they are aiming at our, you might say, blind spots. And that is, in a manner of speaking, deliberate. And some people find that frustrating, and then they kind of give up on it, which I think is unfortunate. It's okay to find it frustrating, but be good to let it work anyway, instead of just tossing it out. For instance, Master Guishan, one of the Tang Dynasty greats, once in his community, he asked his attendant to call the community director. So the attendant went and got the director. The director came to his room. And Guishan peered at the director and said, I asked for the director. What are you doing here? And the director couldn't think of anything to say, or at least didn't say anything. And by and by, he just went away. So a little later, Guishan said to the his attendant, please, would you get the head monk to come and see me? So the attendant dutifully went and got the head monk. Head monk came to the abbot's room. And Guishan said, pardon me, I asked for the head monk to come and see me. What are you doing here? And the head monk didn't say anything. and eventually left. We don't know whether the director and or the head monk were perplexed, or whether their silence was eloquent. Guishan was perhaps inviting them and meeting them as open systems. Having summoned them by, not even by name, but by title, he was meeting them as open systems. The story doesn't say that the interaction continued beyond that, but it certainly could have. In the world of sentient beings, if someone asks to see us, and then we go to see them, and they say, "What are you doing here?" we might conceivably be indignant and say, "Excuse me, my time is valuable. I do not care for these silly games." Or we might recognize that the summons had a deep purpose. The summons might serve as a reminder that our being is somehow unconfined. In spite of what our habits tell us to the contrary. And that the, as Dogen tells us, the gate of liberation does stand open. Another tale. A master, Jing Qing, was out in the courtyard with one of his fellow practitioners, and it was raining. And they were standing there, and Jing Qing asked his companion, What's that sound outside the gate?" And the fellow says, "That's the sound of rain." Jing Qing peers at him and says, "Today, people are confused about themselves and chase around after things. And they're out of touch. And his companion was puzzled and said, "Well, what about you, teacher?" And Jingqing said, "Oh, I hardly ever forget about what I am. And his companion said, "Well, what does that mean?" And Jingqing said, "To bring forth the body is easy. To use the body, not so easy." This story, too, is about practice and realization in the midst of totally ordinary phenomena, such as the sound of raindrops. And how those phenomena face, in a manner of speaking, both towards I'd say the ordinary and the mystery, towards the habitual and the ungraspable, and it's the same with our practice. Our practice of sitting still in each moment faces both the ordinary and, pardon the expression, the holy. We say anybody can bring forth the body. Right? There's nothing to that. Anybody can raise a hand, step forward, say hello. But to turn about in the place where there's suddenly no room, to manifest three heads and eight arms, when the teacher says, "I called for the head cook, what are you doing here?" It requires some spirit, maybe some conviction that this body mind is open to everything. Some experience of practice that lets us know that that is true. Some experience of raindrops that is both ordinary and extraordinary. And Dogen basically called this practice verification, practice realization. And he was adamant about not separating them. Adamant. Adamant about not practicing so that one day you can hear raindrops as extraordinary. Adamant about practicing with the sound of rain right now as Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, Nirmanakaya, right now. This is what he called Zazen. And how do you do that? Well, pretty easy actually. You let the sound of the rain summon you. And if you think it's summoning the person you know you are, then you let the sound of the rain say to you, I asked for Nick. What are you doing here? Eventually, the sound of the rain always asks for the person you don't know you are. And that's its magic. All we have to do is listen. The same for car horns and crying babies and whatever else is going on. And it works that way because this is an open system. You don't have to do anything to make that be so. Thank you for listening. Maybe we just have time for the memorial ceremony, which is short, and then be ready to receive Isan's sister if she should show up. Are there any questions? Maybe a question or two? Yeah, Dave.
Use your metaphor of the prism. Let me see if I kind of got this straight sort of, and put it in a real sort of just as ordinary as I can put it, which maybe is too obvious. it's like Buddha nature, shall we say. It's shining through this prism of our past karma, creating what we regard as ourselves in a normal, everyday sort of viewpoint. Would you say that's more or less what you were talking about?
Well, I want to be careful not to put too fine a point on it. The prism also is Buddha nature. The prism and the shining, all of that is Buddha nature. So I don't want to assign too restrictive roles to too many of the pieces, mm-hmm. but more or less, yes.
So then, in our current lives, with this karma from some time before that's still manifesting itself, and we have an option, I guess, to cut off that karma or continue to sort of wallow in it and let it fester and grow and develop into God knows what would happen in the future. Mm-hmm. And I guess from the point of view that you were just talking about, that's all Buddha nature too, right?
Yes. And as our understanding of that clarifies, the generation of new karma falls away. Karma is only generated based on wrong view. As wrong view ceases, so does karma. So, Buddha thought that ending wrong view was a real good thing, because then karma comes to an end. And of course, you know, as Dogen likes to point out, when you're sitting zazen, generally speaking, what precept is not kept? What wrong view is indulged in? This is why he thought zazen was such a good idea. So, then of course it becomes a matter of the bodhisattva vow bringing us to rebirth over and over again, but on a very different basis. On the basis of vow rather than on the basis of ripening karma. Kind of a better deal.
I hope this isn't too superficial, but from what you were saying today, I just heard so many bells go off from the past. It seems as if the auditory channel is somehow privileged in the Zen literature or even the Zen itself over the other kinds of senses through which the occasion of realization may arise for us. Am I getting that wrong? And if I'm not getting it wrong, why would one channel be more important than another?
I think that's just a bias of meditators, that's all. Just because they have to be sitting, not looking at anything, and the ears are still functioning. I think that's all there is to it. They're just sitting in the hall and they're hearing things, but they're not looking at anything. Personally, that's kind of been my experience. So I think that's where that comes from. It's not that there's anything particularly better about hearing. But when you're sitting very still and either with, in some traditions, eyes closed or eyes not moving, you're still hearing many of the sounds of the world undiminished. So I think that's where that comes from.
Yeah. But you're also, you know, feeling like your ear itches.
Yes.
And or... oops, I just passed a bubble of gas through my lower intestine, or whatever it is that, you know, yeah. some bodily sensation, that those are kind of unavoidable too, as
yes,
well.
Yes, so. That's true. All of the senses are functioning, but in terms of sensory input, I just think of long afternoons in the Zendo at Tassajara during Sesshin, the ears just seemed to pick up an awful lot of input, particularly birds and wildlife and the creek and the wind and so forth.
A little more sort of substantial or something than some fleeting itch.
Yeah, sort of a constant soundtrack. Whereas the other stuff would come and go, but there was always something playing, so to speak. And I think that might be a fairly common experience, especially in Chan and Zen, where you don't try to shut off sensory input, unlike some traditions where they do. That would be my thought, anyway.